Hello and welcome to the Armenian News Network Gurung Week in Review. I'm Asmet Bedrosyan, and along with Hovig Manucharyan, this week we're going to talk about the following major topics. What's going on with the armed forces? Report from Sunik.
And to talk about these issues, we have with us George Tabakyan, who is co-founder of Repat Armenia Foundation, Sahman NGO, and executive director of the RR Foundation, which works mainly on projects with the Ministry of Defense in Armenia. And Karen Vartanesyan, editor of Razminfo, a specialty website on military and warfare strategies with a focus on Armenia and the neighboring region. Hello and welcome, everyone.
Hello, Hovig.
Hello.
So what is going on in the army? We have several different national security-related topics today, but I think we can begin with the latest interview with Armen Grigoryan from the National Security Council. Yesterday, Armen Grigoryan gave an interview to Armenian Public TV, and Grigoryan's answers about Turkey sparked a lot of criticism and reverberations on social media. According to the Armenian National Security Strategy, published in July of 2020 by Grigoryan himself, Turkey is distinctly mentioned as a national security threat. Yet, during the interview, Petros Lazaryan asked him directly multiple times, three times I believe, whether Turkey continues to be considered an enemy of Armenia, and each time he refused to answer. Instead, he hinted that there is a review of the stance, mentioning regional integration processes, and so forth. Karin, I'd like to begin with you. What is your take on this? I know you had an interesting Facebook post on this. Coupled with Pashinyan's public speeches last week, where he said something like, we're enemies because we perceive ourselves as enemies, and so forth. I'm paraphrasing. Do you think that there is some serious rapprochement with Turkey going on right now?
Actually, today Pashinyan restated what was said yesterday by Armen Grigoryan, and it was done just to show that there was no mistake. It wasn't a slip by Grigoryan. About how I see this. Actually, Turkey is in a very big game in Central Asia on post-Soviet territory with plans to join the China's Great Belt Project to get its share of control on the transportation routes. And what we see now in the region, in Karabakh, in Sunik, in Central Asia, even in Ukraine, I think are part of that Turkey's push towards Central Asia, let's say. I mean, I see this as Turkey is benefiting in several ways. First of all, it tries to bring the conflicts to the territory which was considered as Russia's priority, so former Soviet Union territories. In answer to Russia's bringing conflicts to Turkish borders, which is how Turkey perceives Russian activities in Syria, Libya, Iraq, the same Turkey is trying to do here. So I think that it's not about our perception of Turks, our perception of neighbors. This is just a part of big game. And in this game, if we are on Russia's side, we will be considered as a Turkish enemy and as, let's say, fair game for Turkey. Actually, not only we. I mean, Turkey was never shy about hitting anyone when it is needed. For example, Iraq was never a threat to Turkey, but Turks are interfering or meddling in their internal affairs. When needed, they even conduct ground operations, ground invasions. They have occupied several regions in Iraq, and not to say about Syria. So we may meet Turks with bread and salt and sink Osama for them, but that won't change much because they have their clear geopolitical goals, they have their programs, and they try to implement them.
In fact, there is some fear that, similar to 2008, this might be another reason why the U.S. government holds the recognition of the Armenian Genocide. But George, I wanted to ask you as well, how realistic can these public statements be when we're just coming out of a humiliating defeat in a war, where Turkey played a pivotal role in killing 5,000 Armenians, maiming so many more? Is this anything else but wishful thinking, in your opinion?
Well, we are hearing about these peace-loving and peace-with-the-neighbors statements and since Pashinyan came to power in 2018. It wasn't very loud in the past 2 years, but we heard it very well. I was only surprised with the timing. I mean, the war just ended four months ago, and we all saw the involvement of the Turkish government and the army in this war. And it was surprising that after only 4 months, they are bringing up this issue when we still have a lot of missing in action soldiers. We have still hostages. The timing was a bit surprising, but we need to be very clear that this is part of all the plan from the beginning. There is a school in Armenia which believes that if we have good relations with Turkey and Azerbaijan, we will prosper and we will live happily. And this school, unfortunately, the school of thought, unfortunately, won in 2018. It came to power. And their final plan was what we saw in Artsakh. Let me remind you that, as Garen mentioned, Pashinyan himself today reinstated what Armen Grigoryan said. Today, a couple of My Step MPs, they also reinstated. One of them is the famous Maria Garabedian, who is known for her, you know, peace seminars with the Azerbaijanis. So she also reinstated that. Now, the question remains, how much it's real. I believe they are having negotiations with Turkey right now. And one of the points of these negotiations is to prepare the people for peace with Turkey, as they did with Azerbaijan for the past for the past 2 years. So the Turks know how the Armenians are. They think about Turkey. They know what happened during the war. We saw how Turkey was involved. I mean, we were fighting the Turkish army more than the Azerbaijani army. So it seems part of those negotiations is to prepare the population for peace with their neighbor. And that's what now Armen Grigoryan and the rest of the people in power are doing right now.
George, what does peace with Turkey mean?
Peace with Turkey means opening borders. It means, you know, making Yerevan another Batumi for me, inviting Turkish capital to the city, importing a lot of Turkish goods at cheap price. In the past, if it was coming or if it is still coming from Georgia, now it can be imported directly.
So you are primarily talking about trade relations, economic relations?
Well, that's how you occupy a country, actually. And this is what now has happened in Batumi. Batumi is a Georgian city on the Black Sea, but everything is Turkish there, starting from real estate to restaurants to the business and all that.
I'm concerned about what kind of a price Armenia is ready to pay for this politically, because even last week, I think there was the prime minister was in the regions and said that we do not know exactly where the enmity started, which was an amazing statement.
You know, this has happened always. And if we go back in history, even before 1915, this is not a topic that we discuss loudly, unfortunately. But if we study that period, the ruling, let's say, elite in Istanbul, which was mainly the Dashnak Constitution Party, it was also divided. There was a group which was saying that we need to be prepared. And there was the other group, headed by Grigor Zohrab, was saying we need to have peace with them. They are good friends, blah, blah, blah. After the independence, in Armenia, we had this school of thought. And the head of this school of thought is actually a very famous, I don't know how to call him, Jiray Libaridian. If you read his thoughts and his articles, this is exactly what he said in the 90s. And let's remember, he was the advisor of the president back then. And this school has been always in Armenia. It was always weak. In 2017, This school of thought got around 2-3% of the elections. Their Bedrosians, I'm talking about their Bedrosian parties.
Right.
If you read their manifesto back then, it was exactly what Mr. Libaridian says, you know, peace with neighbors, opening borders, and Armenia will prosper, and. But, I mean, we have a long history with these people. It's not 20, 30 years. It's not 100 years. We have a history of 200-300 years with Turkey. So, I believe that, I mean, peace with these people is not simple. It's not simple at all.
First of all, I don't think that we are going to get anything like economic growth, et cetera, for so-called peace. Actually, Turkey is not interested in helping Armenia, even at the cost of some concessions from Armenia. I mean, it's not a partner relationship between partners. We are not equal partners, but what they want isn't partnership at all. They just want to dictate their conditions and get what they want. Currently, Armenia is not in situation, and first of all, because of Pashinyan, to negotiate anything. We actually, what was signed, it was a capitulation, if we talk straight. And those who sign capitulation, they can't negotiate anything. And Turkey and Azerbaijan are moving with this logic. They don't offer anything to Armenia currently. They just want control over Sunik to have a corridor which will help them to connect to Iran, to Central Asia, and to China. They don't need Armenia here. And that would be actually a competitor to Baku, Tbilisi, Kars railway. And if in the case of Baku, Tbilisi, Kars, they have to pay something to Georgia, pay taxes, custom taxes, customs, etc. In this case, it's they just get free ride here. So they don't need peace, actually. All they need is more and more control over Armenia. They aren't going to invest into Yerevan unless there is something is needed to them, let's say some infrastructure or whatever, but they aren't going to invest anything. So these promises of some economic growth, et cetera, it's just another bluff by Pashinyan, and he's famous for his bluffing, actually. I mean, if you were Azerbaijani or a Turk, why would you invest into Armenia? Why would you help Armenia become stronger if we are defeated, if we are on the verge of an existing as a state? Why would they help us to, let's say, get better, to ease our situation? I don't think they are going to do this. Yeah, they are talking about economic something here. And mostly it's not Azerbaijanis, but rather Pashinyan, who has became something like a speaker to Ilham Aliyev and Erdogan. But if you analyze this, why would they invest into Armenia? Why would they support us economically? I don't see any logical explanation for this from their point of view. As for Turkey's army fighting us in Karabakh, there was lots of Turkish support on the level of officers, of running, operating Bayraktars, etc. But I still wouldn't call that a fight of Turkish army. It was Azerbaijani army's fight. And it was actually the total breakdown of chain of command on Armenian side that brought this defeat on us.
Okay, thank you. So the next topic, you know, we've been following the situation around the general staff in Armenia, over the past weeks. And the end result is that Oni Gasparyan is apparently no longer, and he recognizes that he's no longer the chief of staff in Armenia. The new appointee is Artak Davtyan, who's been in that position before and was fired by Nikol Pashinyan. I wanted to ask you, Karen, if you can give an assessment of Artak Davtyan. Do you think he's qualified? What do you think are going to be his priorities? And what are his successes from 2018 to 2020? And what are some of his failures?
Artak Davtyan, before all this started, Artak Davtyan was considered to be quite a good, capable, knowledgeable officer. He was the chief of operations in General Staff, which is actually the heart of General Staff. So, as a professional military leader, I think he's quite capable. The problem with him, and actually almost every other high-ranking general in the army now, is that, that's my personal opinion, of course, is that Pashinyan has made them part of the power game, or whatever you call it, of his power game. So
the political games.
Yeah, the power struggle in the government. And the problem is that in this situation, in this time when Armenia should have been concentrated on recovering from losses, on buying new arms, on building new military infrastructure, on doing everything to recover our security system. Instead of that, the army is busy with political games, with political struggles, with hitting each other, etc., etc. I don't like this at all because we are in very risky situation. Given that Turkey and Azerbaijan, they don't consider this the war with Armenia over. There have been, both threats, and actually there have been even skirmishes. We had people killed in action. We had prisoners of war after November 10th at the Trilateral Declaration, or whatever it is called. So the war isn't over. In Hamaliyev, Turkey, they continue to threaten Armenia. They continue to arm, they continue to recover from war, they conduct exercises, very actively military exercises, but Armenia acts as if, we are in the middle of the ocean with our closest neighbor being 1,000 kilometers away. And while our enemies are preparing for a new war, and I'm sure they are going to use any opportunity to hit Armenia again, because Armenia as a state is a problem for them. And I'm sure they won't leave a chance. They are not going to leave a chance to get rid of Armenia if they ever get such a chance. So, what's going on in army now is very, very worrying.
George, you have served in the military and continue to work with the armed forces. Can you talk about the morale there and the readiness of the army in general?
Well, first of all, small correction. I'm in the reserve, but I haven't served in the forces. You know, the first enemy of any army, the first enemy of the army is uncertainty. And that's what we have today in the armed forces. So I cannot get into a lot of details of what will happen if a war started. And I fully agree with Garen that the war is not over. And, it's not, we're not saying anything secret here. They are announcing that from both sides of the border, Azerbaijan and Turkey. For them, Armenia is an issue as a state. For them, Sunik is a big problem and a big obstacle for Nakhichevan and Azerbaijan to join. So Turkey having a land transport with Azerbaijan. So the army right now, or in the past 5 months, the army the general staff or the Ministry of Defense should have been busy rebuilding what we have lost, rebuilding the arms, rebuilding barracks, and importantly, rebuilding the morals of the army. And you know, all this means money. And if you have noticed in the past 2 weeks, it was announced that the budget of the army was cut off. Cynically, it was, I mean, the deputy prime minister, Avignon, told the people from the army saying that why we need to increase your finance or even keep the finances the same if you have lost the war. It was very cynical and improper feedback, I think.
Yes, that was a huge slap to their face.
But if I'm not mistaken, they also denied that the budget is changing. Obviously, I think the budgetary discussion has not been made public yet. But Karen, do you also think that this news about the reduction of the military budget is true, or there is some truth to it?
I think that even if they don't touch the military budget, it was drafted before the war, when they weren't expecting the war.
You mean the reduction was planned before the war?
No, not reduction. The budget for 2021. It was drafted before the war, and it was drafted for the realities before the war. We had infrastructure, we had lots of arms, etc., etc., and lots of ammunition. Now we have huge losses of both arms and ammunition. We have losses of military infrastructure, like military units, like border, some border infrastructure, security infrastructure, etc., etc. To recover that, a huge increase in budget should be made. For example, Azerbaijan, they increased their military budget for 20%. Another thing that George mentioned, and I think it's important, is that talking about morals, talking about generals, etc. We got lots of new expenses for the families of fallen servicemen, volunteers, for guys who need to for wounded, for maimed, etc., etc. These are huge new expenses. It looks like these expenses weren't taken into consideration. To actually, these are, as far as I know, these have been even decreased the spendings on these articles, and that creates a huge morale problem for, especially for professional military men, for the officers. I mean, if they see that their fallen comrades, their families are starving, and the government delays their payment, which are guaranteed by law, actually. They delay their payments for months. There are like families who don't get payments, their legal payments for months. The same is for the families of lost in action. The same is for families of wounded, etc., etc., etc. There are lots of problems, and people are put on hold. People, families with small kids, they have been put on hold for months. I know a case, someone I know personally, who died in Shushi on November 8th. His family submitted, or he died on November 8th. He was buried in Yerevan on November 12th, I believe. So it's actually, I mean, it's not a case of missing person. Everything is clear here. And all the necessary paperwork was submitted to the Ministry of Defense on November 12th. Their name was sent to the foundation, to the Servicemen Social Security Foundation, 1,000 Drums Foundation. It was sent to the foundation only 2 months later for no apparent reason. And it took also about 2 weeks for the foundation to transfer the money. etc., etc. And there are many cases like that. So for several months, these people who actually were forced to were forced out of Karabakh because in the territory where their apartment was, they were, I mean, it was lost to the enemy. So these people now live in Yerevan with for 4 months. They have been living in Yerevan for months without any support from the government. And there are thousands of cases like this. And this is, of course, very bad for morale. I mean, who is going to die for his country if the country just doesn't care? And it's done in so blatant, so, I mean, so bad way, like we don't care. It's another, and it's all about, yeah, money. It's all about state budget. So that's another problem, which is not talked about much, but we have this problem and it's going to be a problem for years, I believe.
So with all these budget cuts, but we're also hearing and seeing, you know, Russian military planes, resupplying us. So there is some resupply going on. And we also heard talk about reforms, from different people. Karin, what is the essence of these reforms in your opinion today?
If I know good enough, well enough the language of the how it was called in 1984 by Orwell. Yeah, okay, the language, the double talk lingo, anything that is called reform in Armenia these days is actually about the cuts to numbers. It's about it's the same as with the Defense Army of Karabakh. They are saying that we are going to make a better professional army without the conscripts, which means actually that what they can do is to cut the size of the force from about 20,000 it used to be to around 2,000, 3,000, maybe 4,000 at most, because for a larger force, you will need much more money. You will need supply routes, and we know that Azerbaijan is trying to block any of the supplies.
That's specifically about the Artsakh Defense Forces, right?
Yes, it's for Artsakh Defense Forces. But judging from what is said about the so-called reforms in the Army of Republic of Armenia, it's going to be something like that. There are no official, there are no public discussions. Actually, the general public is left in dark about the essence of these reforms, so-called reforms. So it looks like we are going to have many cuts, actually. And as for replenishing the army, I'm not aware of Armenia receiving any heavy armaments. I have no information on that. So that could be some partial replenishment of ammunition, probably missiles, etc., etc., but in small quantities, actually.
Karin, are they envisioning the reduction of the Armenian army's armed forces from 50,000 down to something else?
I'm not sure about the numbers, but I think there is going to be a reduction, yes, of the army.
Okay.
They are going to decrease the number of servicemen, the number of officers, etc. Though I think we shouldn't be doing quite. We should have been doing quite contrary.
Let me comment on this as well. Unfortunately, what's going on right now, what we are seeing on ground, is totally the opposite of what should happen. I'm not sure of these planes, the Russian planes, what they are bringing to Armenia. Could be for their troops in Gyumri or in Artsakh. But I don't see heavy rearmament of their armed forces. Even if I go further, you know, we have a new border with Azerbaijan, which starts from Vartanis till Mehri. This is the new border which was formed after we surrendered our lands in Kashatay and Karvajar. And this is a new border, should be protected. And still, we don't see any proper reinforcements on this border. Again, it goes back to the first argument we talked about, uncertainty. If they are preparing the country for peace, and which we are seeing that, so it's very logical that they will decrease the number of the troops. They will change the doctrine of the armed forces. So this is the direction which is going. So they are not spending a lot of money on the army, nor new armaments. The border with Azerbaijan, the new border, is not being protected. So the country is getting prepared for peace. But at the same time, I have been to the border several times, and I'm visiting also this week. We are seeing the contrary on the Azerbaijani side. We are seeing heavy engineering works on their border. And when we see a tent on the Armenian side where the soldiers are, you know, guarding the border, we can see a proper structure from their side, even in this bad weather. It all comes back to the uncertainty. Things are not announced. They are decided by few people on the top echelon, including the new Minister of Defense. And the rest of the army is in total uncertainty. I can give you a very small example. The way army serves in Tavush, which is again the border with Azerbaijan, is the same, is different than the way army is serving in Sunik or in Gegharkunik, which are both with Azerbaijan. So the army in Tavush is still doing 24/7 guarding for the border, which was before the war. But now in Sunik and in Gegharkunik, the border is almost open. 90%, I can say, it's almost open. And if you ask even high-ranking officers, they don't know exactly what's going on.
So you were there last weekend, is that correct? Can you tell us maybe? Let's talk about the border in Sunik in more detail. So what did you see last week when you were there? Can you guide us through your visit there?
What we are doing in Sunik, let me tell you shortly so you understand why we were on the border. One of the NGOs that I co-founded, it's Saman NGO. We work in the border villages of Tavush for 9 years now. We help villagers to create new incomes so they stay in their villages. And now with the new border in Sunik, we decided to move the NGO operations to Sunik. So that was the purpose of our visit. So when you are visiting border villages, it's natural that we also take a look on our forces on the border, especially that they are very close. The situation is, I would use again the same word, uncertainty. Uncertainty within the people, the population, the army, the forces. Different parts of the border
are... Local authorities, actually.
Local authorities also. Sunik is the only region in Armenia where all the local authorities are against the ruling regime in Yerevan. So it's the cities and the villages, the mayors are mostly, I can say, more than 90-95% are against the ruling regime. Even they established a new political party, which is mainly in Sunik, with all those mayors and the head of mayors and the previous governor.
George, is that because of current realities or is it because of their former relationships, allegiances, and political motivations?
It's about the current, what's going on. I mean, they are not understanding. The question I got from many people saying, where is our army? Why our army is in the barracks, not on the border? If you go to the border, some places it's protected by our border guards, which are under the NSS. They are not under the armed forces. They are under the NSS.
Yeah.
These are the places where we have issues on the border with the road. And it's huge, actually. It's more than 21 kilometers in Shurnuh and Davitbeg, and another 4 kilometers in the south with Rapan and Jagaden. So our the border guards are there. And as you know, our border guards are, they use light weaponry. They are not, they are the same people who guard the border with Georgia, which has been quiet for the past 30 years. So these same border guards are here, but on the other side, the Azerbaijanis are also using their border guards Here I would use quotations for the border guards, because their border guards are the same, they're same soldiers, but they have different uniform. And we all remember these border guards, they were fighting our army in July 2020. So some of the border is covered by those border guards. In other places, there are some reserve forces. These are villagers who are from the village. They are covering their side of the border. In some places, I saw army units, and it was not clear for them why they are there.
George, and about the Azerbaijani border guards, are they also lightly armed or are they heavily armed?
Well, I haven't seen their arms, but if you remember a couple of weeks ago, there was a video out from Sunik where the Azerbaijanis were drinking and they were, you know, shooting. And from the shots of this shooting, I wouldn't say it was an AK-47. It was a light weaponry. Mm-hmm. So they had heavy weaponry. And let's keep in mind that they took over Sanasar, where we had a big barrack there, Hubatlu, as they call it. So they are based there, and all their armed forces in that region are served from that point. And they are using our roads. So because from Hubatlu, we don't have proper roads to these villages, so they are using our main roads for serving these units.
Through Armenia proper?
Through Armenia proper. We're talking about Davidpeg, Shurnuh, Vorodan, Eyvazli, this main road, which is a proper asphalt, and it's easier for them to use this road rather than use this mountainous, very bad roads that we had before.
Okay.
Of course, so when they are moving on these roads, they are with the Russians, but many people have seen photos of these vehicles without any Russian companionship. What I have seen were with the Russians. I have seen a couple of those vehicles, you know, transporting soldiers and ammunition and food and stuff like that. They had Russian companions, so like four Russian soldiers would be driving in front of these vehicles. But the locals told me that it's not always the case. We have seen them, you know, just moving along with their vehicles. So again, it's the story of uncertainty, and the way the army or our armed forces are deployed. We're talking about not only the army, including the border guards and these reserve units. It creates a huge uncertainty within the population.
When you actually traveled on that road, did you have any sort of encounters yourself? Or, you know, are those signs saying welcome to Azerbaijan very prominent on the road? What was your experience like?
Well, I mean, when I saw the pictures on Facebook the first time, you know, as everything in Armenia, fake news is the most powerful news in Armenia. So you doubt in everything. Even if the head of the state says that, you know, the cheese is white, you need to make sure that the cheese is white, because everything is fake today. So you need to double check all the news. I was very hesitant that this cannot happen. You know, this is a nightmare. But when you travel on these roads, yeah, you can see welcome to Azerbaijan, especially the part when it goes from Vorodan, and you remember we talked about this, I think 2 months ago.
Yes.
When you go to from Goris to Vorodan, there is a 4 kilometer road which is proper, which is now considered proper Azerbaijan, and this is their road. They are on their road. They go and come without the Russians there because it's totally within Azerbaijan according to the maps.
If I can add a qualifier, it's considered proper Azerbaijan by probably. Not everyone. I mean, we know that there were some sort of readjustments of positions, but...
The problem is the following. If our government has agreed on this border, even if they are declining, they are saying, you know, we haven't, this is not the final border. I mean, who will move the Azerbaijanis from there? And if they have, Avinyan himself, he accepted saying that, yes, we used the last... Soviet maps, and he didn't know which map he's talking about.
Just in the last couple of days, they mentioned that they were using the 1976 Soviet maps, and they said temporarily.
Actually, he said this before. He said we were using maps. Even Armen Grigoryan said we are using the Soviet maps. Avinyan, it was the first time he mentions these maps, 1975-76, Actually, these maps are 1974 maps. They didn't even know what the date properly. Okay. So if the government has accepted these borders, and tomorrow if we accept the independence or the Azerbaijani state, which we haven't done yet, so this will be the proper border. And if tomorrow border. We have any conflict, de facto border, yeah. And if tomorrow we had any conflict on this border, and if we say, you know what, these 100 meters are ours, who will remove them from there? It's a big question. Now, coming back to that road from Goris to Eyvazlu, the situation is much worse than how it's presented in Yerevan. In Yerevan, we heard that, okay, when you are driving on that road, the last checkpoint is the NSS checkpoint. We don't have any army units there. So the NSS checkpoint is the last point. They will give you a telephone number that if something happens with you, you have to call them on this number. So when we went there, the same situation happened. And my question was the following. If something happens with me on that border, in that section, in that 4 kilometers, can you guys drive there? And the guy from the NSS, he said, you know what, I cannot, we're not allowed to get in that region because that's Azerbaijan. What we do is we call the Russians who are in that region. They have a checkpoint there and they will come and help you. So you're giving, so if something happens in that point, you are giving a call to the NSS. The NSS passes your telephone number to the Russians and the Russian checkpoint, they will send a patrol to the point to see what's your problem and how to help you.
Anything else you want to add to your report from Sunik, George?
If we stay away from the border, although Sunik is now it's a border region because it's surrounded. I mean, most of the borders of Sunik are now Anhichevan and Azerbaijan. The population are much more adequate than what we see in Yerevan. First of all, you don't see any supporters of the current regime. I didn't see anybody. The population is, the people, the villagers even, they were very out loud saying that, you know what, these lands were sold. So we didn't lose them by war, they were sold. They are trying to self-organize themselves with what they know and what they can. And I think that was the reason why that political party grew up there or is established. Some members of this political party are Republicans. They are previous Republicans, and they are not hiding it. They are saying it loudly. Mm-hmm. But now they have regrouped to a smaller political party, which is very influential, actually, knowing their background and knowing their connections. And they are trying to help the population in Sunni. But again, this is something that the government has to do because a political party, even a governor, cannot find the funds to build, you know, new roads, to build new infrastructure. And we're not talking about the army and the infrastructure of the army on the border.
Karen, do you have any questions for George?
Actually, not questions. If we have some time, I would like to add a couple of things.
Sure.
About the border guards of Azerbaijan. Here in Armenia, we consider border guards to be a smaller, weaker, lighter force, which is an understandable stereotype for Armenia. We always, part of our borders was controlled by Russia, the borders with Turkey and Iran. And the other part was controlled by the army. So, yes, our force is smaller, lighter, less people, etc. But in Azerbaijan, border guards are actually the second army of Azerbaijan. Their force is about 12 to 15,000, I think even more after they got their share of border in Pavush in 2017, on which is actually a contact line. They don't have as much heavy equipment as the army, but they have tanks, they have artillery, something that our border forces never had. Actually, during the 44 days war, the last war in Karabakh, the latest war in Karabakh, they were fighting along with the army. And actually, the mercenaries from Syria, they were operating under the aegis of border forces of Azerbaijan. So that's a quite capable force, not very far from being something comparable to our border guards, especially given the fact that the Armenia's border guards, they were commanded by a guy who was dismissed of his position because of very bad management during the war, even during the war. So, I mean, these two forces, they aren't comparable at all. Azerbaijani border guards are a much stronger force.
About the borders, before we move on, George, you and we have talked about the borders on this show many times before. There was a note, I think it was from Avinyan this week, Dikran Avinyan, saying that what is going on the border is not border demarcation, because that takes bilateral relations between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and those relationships do not exist at present. What do you think he meant? I mean, what's going on the border if it's not demarcation and delineation?
Well, what Avinyan is saying and doing is complete lie and complete manipulation. Complete manipulation. And unfortunately, people who don't know these things, they just, you know, they just believe him. Well, when you say demarcation and delimitation, first of all, the process is the following. The two countries, they sit together and say, okay, this is our border on map. And this is called demarcation. This is the first process. I'm talking about the international, how internationally works. I have been in a committee like that between Lebanon and Israel in 2000. So that's how I know the process. So first of all, there will be a demarcation. Both sides will sit down together. They will put the mat on the table and they will start, you know, drawing the border. The way it's done, they can use, you know, available info, old maps, you know, old documents. It depends. So this is the first step. And then the second step is basically going on ground with the GPS equipment and, you know, putting this demarked line, which was on the map, mm-hmm. putting it on the ground, which is called the delimitation. And then, you know, if the countries are in peace, they can just have a small fence like between Armenia and Georgia. If the country is in war, then they can have their military units or whatever engineering works you have on the
reinforcements
border.
On the border. Yeah.
Reinforcements. Now, between what's happening today, we already have agreed on the 1974 map as a basis. So the demarcation is done. Now, he's saying that we don't have meetings with the Azerbaijanis. I don't believe that, because if we have agreed on this map, we have agreed with somebody. It will be like either the Russians or the Azerbaijanis or both. And in many cases, in Sunik, I heard this from the local population. The Azerbaijani forces will come to our posts and will say, guys, you have to leave because this is our area. And our guys will say, no, we're not leaving because we don't have a command or we don't have an order. And then after 2 days, somebody will come from the Ministry of Defense or the minister himself saying, you know what, you have to leave because this is their area right now. So if they have agreed on this Soviet military maps of the version 1974, the demarcation process is already done. What's happening right now is the delimitation. And it's true that they are not putting any physical fences or physical objects on the border. But if they are saying that this is the border and 50 meters away, mm-hmm. the Armenians can sit, and 50 meters away, the Azerbaijanis can sit. So this is the delimitation process. But as everything else in Armenia, things are done in their way. They change the names. And they say, you know what, we're not doing demarcation, we're not delimitation. So what are you doing, guys? And we have an experience like that in 1994. When the war was over, both sides, you know, there was a consensus from both sides that we are staying wherever we have occupied during the war. I'm talking about Tavush, not Artsakh. During the war in Artsakh, 92-94, mm-hmm. the same smaller scale operations were going on in Tavush, and our armed forces, or back then they were small armed units, we didn't have the army yet, they had occupied hills and the territories which were outside this Soviet border, and they agreed the consensus was in 1994, when we signed that treaty in May, so the soldiers will stay wherever they are, and the engineering for reinforcement started built up there. And for now, we have until today, actually, we have that in Nakhichevan, and we have that in Tavush, and we have that in Gerharkunik.
Right.
But here, what happened is the war was over. The agreement said that both forces should stay wherever they have reached until 9 November. We were 4, 5, sometimes 10 kilometers away from the contact line right now in Sunik, because we had the mountains, we had the hills, you know, to protect the villages properly.
Yeah.
But I think it was on the 17th of December, the Minister of Defense, the new appointed Minister of Defense, he went himself to Sunik and said, you know what, we have to remove the forces from here because the new border is whatever the Azerbaijanis are saying. So the process right now is delimitation. I would call it delimitation. Tomorrow and any time after tomorrow, the Azerbaijanis can come and build a fence there, and they will say, you know what, this is our new border.
Thank you so much, everyone. I think we're going to be leaving it there, and you have a great week ahead.
Thank you.
And that concludes our program for this episode of Gurung Weekend Review. We hope it has helped your understanding of some of the issues from this previous week. We look forward to your feedback and suggestions for issues to cover in greater depth. Contact us on our website at gurung.org, that's G-R-O-O-N-G, and on our Facebook page, ANN-Gurung, or in our Facebook group, Gurung-Armenian News Network. Special thanks to Laura Osborne for providing the music for our podcast. I'm Hovik Manacharyan, and on behalf of everyone in this episode, I wish you a good week. Thank you for listening, and talk to you next week.